Coming out of the pandemic, fiscal and monetary stimulus provided support for fundraising, deals, and exit activity within the private equity market. Even as fiscal stimulus has waned and the Federal Reserve has tightened policy, better-than-expected economic activity and earnings have supported recent performance. For investors looking to supplement their public equity allocations, private equity can help enhance portfolio returns, as it has done for multiple decades, and provide exposure to rapidly growing companies at the forefront of key market trends and themes. That being said, private equity does have the drawback of lower liquidity, and higher interest may pose a threat to future returns. For today's episode, I'm joined by my colleague Stephen Catherwood, co-head of our private equity group with over 20 years of experience on the team, who will dive deeper into the current balance of risks and opportunities in the private equity market. Also, if you're listening to this audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning into our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked to the show notes. So let's get started. Stephen, welcome to Insights Now.
Thank you for having me, David.
So perhaps you can help me understand a little bit about what our private equity business looks like here at JP Morgan Asset Management. What kind of strategies do we deploy, and how do they differ from each other?
Sure. So the team at JP Morgan within asset management is over 65 people, and the business has existed here since 1997, but was actually founded by a group of individuals that came over from a large corporate pension plan in 1997. And so the history and track record of the team and some of the key relationships that we have in the market actually date back to the early 80s. But private equity, it's a very different asset class than most others, and it's harder to access, right? Unlike a public equity fund where you could buy into an index fund very quickly, get broad diversification, send money once to buy into that fund and leave it there if you're pleased with its performance. There are a lot more complexities to private equity in the sense that these are closed-end drawdown structures, meaning you can't get liquidity if you want it, and the capital is called as the underlying investments are found and deals are done. And so the process of building out a portfolio across a number of managers and assets to provide broad diversification, since a lot of private equity firms may only do 10 or 15 deals in a fund. If you're an institution or an investor that wants to find and build a broadly diversified portfolio and then manage that over time, it is much more labor intensive. So what we do as a business is provide investors access points to private equity and venture capital. And they can either do that holistically by outsourcing all elements of that to us or using us to access some different slivers of what we do in various components of our investment engine, which really break down to your question about the strategies as follows. The two main buckets are venture capital and private equity, which have relatively different characteristics but are often lumped under the same umbrella. And we do both. Primarily on the venture capital side, what we're doing is finding best-of-breed firms that are engaged in the entrepreneurial networks and ecosystems and essentially are trying to find the next great technology business or largely healthcare business, some consumer. Mm-hmm. And then on the buyout side of the equation, we're accessing that market through a few different means. One, we're investing in best-of-breed fund managers that have particular expertise and niche in an area. But then we're also co-investing alongside them directly into companies to enhance returns and average down fees, as well as purchase secondary interests. So because these are closed-end, long-duration vehicles, there are points where a few years in, an investor may say, for one reason or another, I need capital back. I can't get liquidity from the manager, but I can go on the secondary market and sell that interest, and so we do that as well. So a couple different access points and ways that we can maneuver the market to build diversified portfolios and help investors access the asset class.
Interesting. It almost seems like the way to distinguish between venture capital and buyout, it's almost like the new car market and the used car market. I mean, companies involved in buyouts, they've got a track record. It's not just about capital, but we think that we can manage them better, essentially.
And that's exactly right. And that's, I think, when I first got into the business, if you go back even earlier to the 80s and 90s, people often thought about private equity as, well, this was a way of just, or leveraged buyouts, to just go buy assets on the cheap. Mm-hmm. And people are still obviously hunting for value, but there's so much more focus on accelerating growth and better managing the businesses, and that's where we spend most of our time.
And that probably means that company size has something to do with this. I mean, in terms of company size, what kind of companies are you looking for?
Yeah, so we focus most of our energy within venture capital on the early stage. That we want to find managers that have the ability to identify the next generation of entrepreneurs and get in very early. Mm-hmm. You'll have a much higher loss ratio, but then you have the potential to participate in outsized returns for the winners. On the private equity or the buyout side of the equation, we focus our energy on the small and mid-market. And what that means in terms of the fund sizes that we pursue is they are generally, we define small market as up to $1 billion, mm-hmm. mid-market up to $3 billion. There's no standard accepted range for those definitions in the industry, and ours are generally smaller than most. But we really like that end of the market because you can generally buy businesses at lower multiples. You can use less leverage, and the private equity toolkit that can be brought to bear to enhance, to accelerate growth, enhance returns is generally more robust, in our opinion, at that end of the market. The underlying companies that we're investing into at the small market we define as up to $750 million of enterprise value or mid-market up to $1.5 billion. There's still a huge amount of money that is raised at the larger end of the market to do, you know, large and mega-sized deals. But ultimately, our playbook, we think, and we can talk more about why, that the low and mid-end of the market is a more durable, consistent segment of the market that has what we think is better characteristics over a long period of time. And so that's where we focus our effort.
Well, yeah, so yeah, maybe you could expand a little bit on that. I mean, why do we think that?
Because ultimately, you know, the toolkit that private equity can bring to bear, as I mentioned, it can be more impactful in some ways because these smaller businesses, whether you're buying a family-owned business or a business that was founded by an entrepreneur that might want to stay with it but recognizes that the next phase of growth is more complicated. Generally, when you look at those businesses, they have some holes, right? Mm-hmm. They might not have, you know, a professional CFO. They may have never done an add-on acquisition. They might not have built out all of the systems and infrastructure mm-hmm. that you'd expect, you know, a business a well-optimized and run business to have. And so when you bring in private equity firms that are professional owners of businesses that are generally, in many cases, have partners or the whole firm focuses on a particular type of business and sector, there's a lot of pattern recognition and expertise that they are bringing to bear mm-hmm. as an active owner to those businesses. And those changes that they can make by introducing the ability to do add-on acquisitions, to bring in those systems, to bring in better management financial talent, as well as all their experience owning similar assets in the space, that can be more transformative mm-hmm. for those types of companies and then generate alpha. And the reality is when you're at that end of the market, you can, and you have those operational levers to pull on, you don't need to take every last dollar of debt to make the math work on a deal. Mm-hmm. And so at that end of the market, what we also see is, you know, much generally meaningfully lower rates of leverage than you see at the large end. And that has an impact on the overall volatility in our mind, mm-hmm. the overall risk profile that is beneficial at the small mid-end.
It seems like the difference between coaching a young athlete and an old one. I mean, the young one, you can actually give them a lot of expertise they don't have. And the old one comes, you know, maybe they've heard it all before, but they also have their own problems, which you may not be able to deal with any better than they can. So
absolutely.
Very interesting. So right now, across the private equity broadly, where do you see the best opportunities?
Yeah, we're seeing it's been a very interesting environment because in one regard, you know, the asset class has done so well over the past several years, but almost to its detriment in a way, in that a lot of investors that have been longstanding investors in private equity, you know, they managed to target allocations. And when we saw, you know, one of the worst years for the equity and fixed income markets in terms of those valuations retrenching, at a time when private equity was generally still appreciating, a lot of investors ended up pretty heavily over-allocated to the asset class. And the effects of that, the cascading effects that get caused by that create some inefficiencies and opportunities in our market, for example. In one regard, it's become a very difficult market for a lot of managers to raise capital, especially at the small and mid end of the spectrum. Fundraises are taking longer because a lot of folks are saying, well, we're over allocated the asset class. The inefficiency that creates for us is, well, what do managers then do? They want to make their funds last longer. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways they can do that is when they find interesting deals that they want to do, they can carve more of that off as a co-investment and share with their LPs. So this is a situation where a manager finds a deal. It might be right down the middle of the plate. Let's say it's a $100 million equity check. They may say, well, why don't we carve out 30 of that and we'll give it to our investors outside of a fund structure, which means they don't have to pay, you know, fees or carried interest on it. And then from our standpoint, we get the ability to underwrite that business. If we like the plan and we like the asset and we can do it in a more fee efficient way, that can be very value enhancing for return enhancing for our investors, and has been a very strong performing segment of the private equity market over a long period of time. So we actually had the highest rate of co-investments on our platform last year, and I think others that looked like us in the market had a similar experience. If you had capital, you could really take advantage of it in the market. The other thing is the secondary market, which is, as some of those investors are over-allocated, one tool that they have to manage that problem is to go to the secondary market and put pieces of their portfolio up for sale. And this had been a market that for a number of years the pricing was very robust, i.e. sellers could command a very high price. But given what's happened in the market, we've seen, relative to prior years, much bigger discounts available to go in and buy into those funds at more material or assets at more material discounts to their fair market value, build more diversification, and take advantage of some access to some good portfolios in a much more efficient way.
So people are just over-allocated, and it just creates a lot of opportunities when that happens and the money starts drying up, and we can see that this is now priced right. Actually, one thing that we've been, obviously everybody wonders about is 2022 was a terrible year for financial assets in general. And, when the Fed raised rates, public equities fell very sharply. Why didn't private equity do the same thing?
It's a great question. When I first joined the business, the very first venture capitalist I ever met said, there are only 2 days that matter in this business, the day you sign the front of a check and the day you sign the back of a check. And we used to always quote that, and people don't write as many checks anymore, but, it still holds. But back at that point in time, that was a relatively true statement, in the sense that a lot of private equity and venture capital is generally a very small allocation within people's portfolios. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot less focus on what the interim valuations of an asset are, because mm-hmm. it really mattered how much money you got out when you sold it and what it cost when you put in it. But the reality is, as the asset class has matured and there have become it's become a much larger percentage of people's portfolios, there is a lot more focus on, well, what are these interim marks and where are we relative to our target allocations? But the reality is, it relates to what happened is, public markets are ultimately forward-looking, and they are based these are prices that are set by analysts and investors that are looking at the future projections and earnings of companies. The valuation processes that are set for private equity managers are really driven by generally facts, and facts are generally backwards looking. So what are the trailing earnings of the business? If we're going to look at similar businesses and what valuation multiples they've sold, let's look at actual transactions that have occurred. And then firms will oftentimes build in public market valuation comps as a component, but it's not the dominant component. And therefore, what you have is a little bit of dispersion that comes from the fact that public markets are looking forward and private markets valuations are looking backwards. But another key feature that's often, I think, underappreciated is that private equity has been allocating more and more capital to sectors that have more durable and consistent growth characteristics. Mm-hmm. And so when you look underneath the portfolios, there have been more consistent earnings growth at those businesses, which you'll see in some of the guide to market materials as you have, and that has ultimately created more durability in the valuations.
And so part of the answer is that actually public markets move too much. I mean, it's not like these companies actually became 20% less valuable in 2022 and then suddenly became 20% more valuable in 2023. And so perhaps the private valuations are actually much more accurate than what the public market was giving us.
Yeah, we think so. And there are plenty of examples in our portfolio as assets come up for sale. They're still trading, you know, at higher multiples than where they were held. To be fair, there are also cases where people go out and test the market on assets and find that, you know, bids are coming in short of carrying value, and they'll make adjustments from there. But I'd say overall, you know, there's also a control premium that has to be factored in at the end of the day. You know, the trading price of a marginal share in the public market that can be due to a whole host of factors is sort of different than how a controlling interest in a business would trade in a private transaction.
Yeah. Now, having said that, there has been a lot of press about how distributions plummeted in private equity last year. So what's been driving this, and is there any catalyst that could reverse it?
Sure. So that has been, I don't think we've made it a week this calendar year without seeing an article in a major publication about how, you know, buyout distributions or private equity distributions have plummeted. But I think it's very important to bifurcate what's going on in different segments of the market. But to your point about the root cause, there are really two things that happened and this started last year or even late 22, which is as rates moved up and there was more macro uncertainty, the bid-ask spread between buyers and sellers widened. Right, sellers really wanted yesterday's price at premium what had been, you know, relatively high multiples. Buyers are adjusting their price real time, and if you're sitting around the investment committee table at a private equity firm and you're looking at a more uncertain picture for future earnings, and you're looking at the availability of debt, as one of my colleagues said, you can't have an LBO without the L. So as the debt markets, as the cost of debt starts going up significantly and the availability of debt starts to contract when that market started to seize up, especially at the large end, it was harder to make the math work and pay sellers what they were looking for. So this, you have this bid-ask spread that widens. And as a result, a lot of transaction activity dipped, and overall transaction activity is going to highly correlate with distributions that get sent back from these private equity funds. If you fast forward to today, there's really been one of the two problems has been solved. So you had the bid-ask spread and the availability of debt were the two problems. The availability of debt picture has really changed dramatically as a function of, one, a huge amount of capital getting raised for private credit funds that has been coming online, and there's now, I think, a little bit more pressure for folks to deploy and not just sit on the sidelines and wait. And then the banks coming back in a bigger way in that market. So the leverage is there. You know, the managers that we talk to in the buyout space, you know, say anecdotally they're getting multiple calls a day from debt providers saying, well, if you don't have any new deals for us, which of your companies can we recapitalize with a new debt structure to deploy capital today? So that the pendulum has swung there, but that bid-ask spread is between buyers and sellers is still a meaningful issue. And ultimately, we do think there'll be more capitulation during the year. That will probably be both sellers becoming more realistic on their price and buyers coming up a bit. But the one thing I would note is it's very bifurcated by segment of the market. Mm-hmm. In a big part because the large end of the debt market really started to seize up, and that was the hardest place to get deals done. Because if you had a company that you owned with, let's call it 6.5x leverage on a multi-billion dollar debt package, a potential buyer of that business literally could not replicate that debt package. Mm-hmm. And that made it, when the markets were tight, and that made it even harder for that deal to get done. Or if you said, well, let's sell that company to a strategic buyer, a larger corporation that wants to own it because they might not have trouble raising the debt. You know, that this was at a period where a lot of strategic buyers were actually dialing back their M&A activity. But the difference is at the small and mid end of the market where we play, we saw much more consistency in outcomes. Our distributions were actually up year over year. And another way to look at it would be to look at the percentage of net asset value or the percentage of your portfolio at the start of the year that converted to cash. And Bloomberg ran an article about a month ago saying that conversion of portfolio value to cash during a year in 2023 was at its lowest level in 15 years since the Great Financial Crisis. And they quoted a number of 11.2%, and you know, within our portfolio, we saw something that was nearly double that, and in part, in a major part, because at the small and mid end, The deals are smaller. It's easier to get the debt. Strategic buyers can absorb acquisitions in a much more digestible way with that check size. And so there's a lot more resilience there. And so I think when we read a lot of these articles about that change in the distribution dynamic, I don't think there's enough attention paid to the bifurcation between what's going on at the large end and the smaller end.
Absolutely. But having said that, and I appreciate the way that you manage this space, but private equity returns from 2013 to 2022 have been about 15% per year. Valuations are now higher. Interest rates are higher. What do you think is realistic in terms of returns going forward?
In some more recent vintages, the numbers have been even much higher than that, depending on how you constructed a portfolio. We get asked that question all the time and would say, the way we think about private equity and the role that it serves in a portfolio is it's ultimately a return enhancer. Mm-hmm. And we believe that in exchange for taking the illiquidity that you have to take by signing up for these fund structures, you should generate a premium to the equity returns that you can get in the public markets. And we talk about generating 300 to 500 basis points of alpha over the public market equivalent. And that's really what we set as a major objective. And so when you think about that as a baseline, then part of the question becomes, well, where do you think public equity markets are going to go forward? And that's a very difficult question to answer. But what we want to acknowledge is private equity as an asset class had pretty much every conceivable tailwind you could ask for several years leading to a change in the rate cycle. And I would argue that most risk assets really benefited tremendously from a lot of those same set of characteristics. So when we get asked the question, well, do you think we'll be able to replicate these returns? We would never have forecasted that returns necessarily would have been that high because we never would have forecasted that you'd have all of those tailwinds coincide. What we do feel very good about is that a well-constructed private equity portfolio should continue, as it has for decades, to generate alpha over a public market equivalent because the private equity toolkit is so powerful, and we think it is a better way to manage businesses. At the end of the day, you instead of having to manage the quarterly earnings, you can look at acquisitions, CapEx plans, and a whole host of other business management decisions on a multi-year time frame that, you know, other companies that are constrained by a quarterly earnings perspective might not want to pursue. And then once you bring in the other benefits of professional ownership, M&A capabilities, et cetera, that we talked about earlier, all of that combines to what we think is a very durable model to enhance and accelerate growth. But the overall rates of return will still depend in some part as to how the public equity
performs. So no promises in absolute terms, but you do feel that it's likely that in relative terms, private equity will still provide a premium in terms of total return over public markets.
That's what we feel. That's what we like to talk to clients about.
That's what's really important because you've got to deal the hand that you're dealt. So private equity funds have built up huge levels of dry powder over the course of the pandemic and the years that followed. How should this be interpreted by investors?
It's a great question. I'd say I've been in the industry for a little over 20 years, and every single one of those years, you know, we've had different interest rate cycles, different earnings cycles. We've had lots of different things that have changed over time. And one of the things that has been constant through 20 years is people asking the question, boy, it seems like there's a lot of dry powder. You know, how is the industry going to digest it? And, you know, the reality is that the target market size for private equity is enormous. Mm-hmm. And there are so many different businesses to pursue, whether it's in the private markets or, you know, you see cases where some larger public companies are taken private, that the addressable market is massive. And so there's really nothing you could look at there to say, well, will there be an issue digesting it? What we've seen over time is the number of businesses and business owners that recognize the value that a private equity partner can bring continues to expand. So to be frank, if you were to go back, multiple decades, and there was this perception of, well, private equity is just the corporate raider that's going to come in and slash and burn, and you'd find folks would say, I will just never sell my company to a private equity firm. As the industry has shifted, you know, those days are long ago, to what exists now, where these firms are purpose-built to try to find ways to accelerate growth in almost all cases. And as more of those, as more of that has played out, the number of business owners that see private equity as a solution continues to expand. Mm-hmm. And then anecdotally, there are also the number of public company management teams and CEOs that may prefer to operate in a private setting because they see the benefits of that has also grown. So the confluence of those factors leads us to the same conclusion that we've had for a while, which is the industry can digest it because it's still a relatively small portion of the overall addressable market.
It's a very old-fashioned metaphor, dry powder. I mean, it's basically based off muskets. But what you're saying is, yeah, we've got a big pile of dry powder, but they're making more muskets. We've got a lot of muskets to fill here.
Yeah, and there are a lot more targets to go after.
Great. Listen, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
On our third episode of Season 9, I'll sit down with Nick Muller, an investment specialist and managing director in our infrastructure investment group, for a conversation on infrastructure. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today and speak with you soon.
This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.